2nd of August 1939. Move of service sections to war site, 15th of August 1939. In order to carry out communication tests, the war site will be manned AM 15th August by those detailed in GCNCS First Wave, who are not on leave at the time. Those going by train should obtain a single ticket of the appropriate class to Bletchley. On arrival, they should place their luggage in the cloakroom, from whence it will be collected after the allocation of billets, etc. They should proceed on foot from the station to the war site. On leaving the station, turn right up the hill and proceed through the second lodge gates. The staff are warned against any conversations regarding the work with other members of the staff whilst in their billets. If occasion should arise as to what you are doing, the answer should be that you are part of the aerial defence of London. Gas masks are to be taken.
This is London. You will now hear a statement by the Prime Minister.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this very special episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, The Best of Reunions, Part 1. For the last 8 years, I've always known where I would be on this day, because each year, to mark the arrival of the Codebreakers to their war station in 1939, we hold our annual Veterans Reunion. It's the highlight of our year and a very special occasion for all involved. The veterans can meet up with friends old and new and share stories about their vital and once top secret wartime work. Each year, the reunion seems to take on even more meaning for our veterans, their families, and all those who work for Bletchley Park Trust today. So I'm sure you'll understand that it's with huge regret that due to COVID-19 restrictions, Bletchley Park Trust has taken the difficult decision not to host our reunion on site this year. To mark what would have been this year's reunion, this is the first of three special episodes we'll be bringing you this month. Not just the highlights of the last 8 years that the podcast has attended, but also from what should have been the last, but became our very first reunion in 1991. Original Trust member Peter Westcombe reminisced in 2014 about how the campaign to save Bletchley Park all started.
Well, I knew Bletchley Park existed from before. When I was with the diplomatic service, I was at Hanslope Park, some 17 miles away. And Hanslope Park is a direct result of the wartime activities of Bletchley Park, because the intercept activity, especially the Abwehr German Secret Service traffic, was intercepted by all my colleagues who then worked in Hanslope Park. So after 1974, when the whole thing came open, they actually told me the stories of what was happening in there. And I got to know so many of them, and I became fascinated. Well, the other thing was this. When I joined the diplomatic service in 1960, I didn't have a house. That we were living down in Essex, so I came up here to stay and try and buy a house. We were then using Hut 3, the intelligence hut, as our hostel. So I knew Hut 3, I knew the other huts, and of course, having heard the story from my colleagues in Hanslope Park, I could put the whole lot together. And I realised, in fact, this site had a story really worth telling. And that's how the whole thing started off. The alarm bell started ringing in early 1991 when there was a meeting of the Bletchley or Milton Keynes Council, I forget now, and the decision in fact was taken there that Bletchley Park did not need to be saved. they could give planning permission for a housing estate, I think, of 300 houses, a garage and a small superstore. Now, I went to that meeting with my good colleague, Peter Jarvis. I had known Peter for years whilst I was in the dip service. I used to come home, my wife and I, and that, with a few bugs, and we used to go and see Peter and that, so we knew Peter very well. Peter and I went down to the meeting, and afterwards we said, well, that's it. There's nothing we can do. See, this was BT property. BT had got planning permission to demolish the site. It was a site, of course, it's a very valuable site. It's just by the side of the railway station. You can fall out of bed, into a train to London, back home again. No parking fees, nothing at all. So we knew it was going to be a bit of a hard one, that we appealed to their better nature. Then I went home, and about 2 or 3 weeks later, I suddenly had an idea. So I suggested to my wife, if we could only get a farewell party here for all the wartime staff we would find, and we get all the media down here to get them to interview them and tell the story, maybe we could do something. I said, but the trouble is, I said, of course, I don't know anyone around here because I spent most of our lives overseas. So she said, well, why don't you ask Peter? He was a GP. He knew everyone for miles. So Rona and I invited ourselves down for tea with Peter and Sue Jarvis, and I discussed the thing with them, and they said, yes, what a good idea to get a party going and to see if we can get the media in. And that's how the whole thing started.
June Marinay Clark. And I was in Hut 8 from June 1940 till the end of Bletchley Park. Hut 8 was working on the German naval enigma.
I'm Derek Taunt. I was in Hut 6 from August 41 until May 45, when the German part of the war ended. Hut 6 was the cryptographers on the German Air Force and Army, and I was involved in various activities, but breaking the code most of the time and doing some rather longer term research at a later time.
My name is Raymond Goodman, and I joined Hut 4. I was in the Navy after some convoy duty, and they sent me to Bletchley because I was alleged to have some knowledge of foreign languages. Actually, the languages I knew were Scandinavian, so naturally they assigned me to read German. And we were the kind of liaison between the cryptographers and the translators on the one side and the Admiralty on the other, which kept a U-boat plot. So we tried to follow and help the Admiralty understand where the various U-boats were during the war. I was there from 42 to 46. Well, we had a collection of all the leading chess players in the country.
They were
all Hugh Alexander, Babbage, Milner Barry himself, of course, chess player.
Hugh Alexander and Stuart Milner Barry, who is here, of course, had both been British chess champion, and Dog Aitken had been Scottish chess champion. He didn't win quite so much.
How are we going to get this party going? So we sat and thought, and the four of us, we said, well, what we need to do, in fact, is A, to get permission to use the park, and B, then to be able to find all the people who were here throughout the war, as many as we can, to invite them in. And C, we've got to feed them. So I said, well, I'll look after A, getting permission to go in the park. Peter said he will look after B, getting the names and addresses of the people, so to invite them. And C, Sue and my wife said, we'll organise the catering. So off we went. So I had some contacts anyway down in the West Country, and I got two addresses off them. One was Harry Hinsley, Sir Harry Hinsley. Another one was Edward Thomas, Captain Thomas of Royal Navy, who was in Hut 4. And they gave the addresses to me. I gave them to Peter. And we said, well, if we write Peter and Sue Jarvis and Peter and Ernie Westcombe, invite you to Bletchley Park. Mind, we hadn't got permission then to invite you to Bletchley Park to this big party. They would say, well, who the devil are these people? But if we say the Bletchley Archaeological and Historical Society, of which we are both members, if we say they invite you, maybe we'll get a result. We asked the Historical Society, and they said yes. So we then had the major meeting. There was Peter and Sue, my wife and myself. Peter got a councillor in, Roger Bristow, and a chap called Ted Legg, who was a local historian, and Ina Halmos, who was the chairman of the Bletchley Archaeological Society. And we all sat in Peter's house, and we had a long chat and decided how to divvy the whole thing up, and this is how it would work. So off everybody went. Well, I had to get into the park. So the gates, of course, were wide open in those days, so I walked in the park and promptly got thrown out. So I then went down the path by the side of the gate, found a gap in the railings where one of the railings had broken off, came back through a gap in the railings, and went into the office where I saw the lady who was, in fact, looking after the place before it was handed over to be demolished. And she said, well, you know, I have to get permission of that. This was dear old Doreen Sawyer. Doreen, by the way, after she retired, for 8 years was one of our most loyal volunteers, bless her heart.
Well, I met my husband because I was told that he played the clarinet and I ought to meet him because I sang. And I met him on night shift and took an instant dislike to him. And I also met another man who played the piano, who I disliked also. And so they said, would we perform to the war workers at Wolverton? There was a factory for railway. I don't know what they made.
Yes.
And we were going to do a clarinet trio, and I was going to sing Shepherd on the Rock with the clarinetist. And I disliked them both so that I never turned up to rehearsals. I always opened the door and said, I'm terribly sorry, I've left the music behind. And we performed this thing. It was appalling. It was so bad that the audience laughed. I mean, it was a lovely atmosphere, but it was just Shepherd on the Rock. Yes, when we did it at Wolverton.
Well, that's when you fell in love with Peter.
Well, coming back, I began to see the error of my ways.
You sang and your mother played the piano.
I know, but I know it was a man, Phillips, played the piano, and he was a pain in the neck.
You were billeted at Woburn, weren't you?
Yes, I lived over the draper shop in Woburn, which is now an antique shop.
And you had a ghost. Who was the woman that you shared with?
Eileen Alderton, who now lives in Sydney and works for Kerry Packer. And she works on the Australian Women's Weekly, which is now a monthly.
She's still writing, is she?
Well, she's still working. She's getting on in years, but she never lets anybody know how old she is.
Same age as you.
No, she's 1 year older than me.
This conversation has been held between Mrs. Rosemary Terry and subsequently Davidson.
And Rosamund Case I was then. And I'm now Mrs. Peter Twin. And Peter Twin is the only person present, I suspect, who was here right at the beginning, before war broke out. He came straight from Oxford. So he's one of the oldest people. You really ought to talk to him. And I don't know where he is.
So I didn't know this till we were coming up to the party. She contacted BT and said, can these people have permission just to throw this farewell party? BT asked, well, about how many people? She said, well, I shouldn't think. No more than about 20. Okay, on that basis, okay. Well, as the invitation list soared past 200, we thought, please don't let BT turn up. Please don't let BT turn up.
He's pointing at me.
Pointing at you.
I don't expect her to say anything. I don't know. Peter, do you want to say a few well-chosen words about who you are and why you are?
That's rather difficult. Yes, I'm Peter Twin. I work on the Enigma, and in fact, I am now the only living British cryptographer to have worked on the Enigma since before the war. There's another colleague of mine with whom I've just been talking to who worked in GCCS, which is this organization's original name. She worked in it in London in 1937 or 38. So we are really the oldest inhabitants, I'm sure. I worked with a lot of very famous people like Dilly Knox, Alan Turing, a number of others. I left at the end of the war, but I didn't wish to make a life task of this. And I went into the civil service and then came out of the civil service. And this is a very remarkable occasion to me.
May I just ask one question about Turing?
Yes.
Only that I saw a play about him in London three or four years ago.
So did I. I thought a most remarkable play. I didn't think it would be possible to make a dramatic play out of what is really an intellectual kind of subject. But when I went there, I was absolutely amazed. I sat on the edge of my chair. The representation of Turing, and let me say, I worked in the same room with Turing for 18 months. I knew him very, very well indeed. I could almost see him on the stage. And the actor playing him was Derek Jacobi, who got him off to a tee. For example, Derek Jacobi quite often came to the front of the stage and stood like this with his arms loosely folded across his stomach. And I was introduced to Derek Jacobi after the play and we were talking. I said, how did you know that was such a very personal attitude? He said, well, I had a couple of photographs of Alan Turing, and in both places he's standing like this, and I came to the conclusion that must have been a personal idiosyncrasy, which is quite true. And the whole representation of his character was so close to the truth, it's eerie.
Yes. How would you describe Turing then?
I knew him very well. Have you read the book by, I can't remember his name, about Alan Turing? It's a very fine book, which I did, in fact, review for the London Mathematical Society. In that, I said, He was a very remarkable man. He was a little shy, interested in almost everything, a very good friend, like so many great people, a little intolerant of idiots, but he was really very pleasant to work with, a great friend, but a mystery. He was, as you know, homosexual. Not that bothers me. I mean, made advances to me, but I'm not particularly interested, but didn't make any difference to our subsequent relationship at all. No. He was a mathematician of a worldwide repute and really laid the intellectual foundations of the whole computer business. Not a particularly practical man, but by no means an unpractical man. One of the things I think they got wrong in the play, everybody describes Alan Turing as having a stammer. Now, he didn't have a stammer. What, in fact, he did was his mind worked so fast. When he was asked an interesting question, he thought about three or four things he wanted to say at once. His voice started to rise and all would bumble together, and all the sentences got jammed up. But it wasn't a stammer. He didn't have a stammer. He had a rather curious characteristic that he couldn't stand the sight of blood. If anybody cut his finger or started talking about medical opinion, he had to leave the room because he'd just pass out. Very strange. I've never come across anybody with that idiosyncrasy. Oh, but he's a marvellous man. The only thing wrong about Derek Jacobi's representation was not his fault at all. It's just that his makeup was a little light because Alan Turing had a very dark head, a big solid head, and he had dark hair and slightly dark chin, and the whole impression of being somber. But he was
a good friend.
Now, Peter has, all these years down the line, confessed that he told you there'd be about 20 people.
That's right. It was a nightmare. He said, would you be able to do anything, Dorian? I said, well, if there's only 20 of you, tea and biscuits, fine. Well, it was over 200, wasn't there? Well, by this time, names started to pour in. Remember, as I said to you, I had not said a word to my boss man. He didn't know anything about this. And in the end, I think when we got over the 100, I thought, no way can I cope with this without saying something. So I went into my boss and I said, look, I've got something terrible to tell you. He says, what have you done? I said, I think I'm going to get thrown out. I said, I've overstepped the mark. And he said, right, let's have it. And I told him, he said, oh, Dorian, what the heck are we going to do? I said, I don't know. I said, I'm just stuck with tea and biscuits at the minute. He says, look, leave it with me. So he rang headquarters in London and told them, and the director said, yes, go ahead with it. It's quite important. See what you can do and sort it out. Permission has been granted. And that's how it started. And believe you me, I never slept for a week. Because every day, I mean, because obviously I was always on duty. So my number had been given. And people were ringing up and saying, well, I'm coming. And I was taking all these names, and I was absolutely astounded. Do you know, this was all done within literally weeks, not months, to organise. We weren't prepared. Chaos.
When you look back on it, it must look a lot more fun than it was on the day.
Oh, it was pandemonium. Yeah. It was pandemonium.
Did he have many friends here at Bletchley?
Well, not many friends.
I don't want to dwell on the sexual side in any detail. It often can result in an intolerance. It can result in that.
I would say there was absolutely no intolerance. He had no intolerance anyone.
I seem to remember in the play. No, I'm sure he wouldn't, but I just wonder whether he was in fact ostracised or victimised. I seem to remember in the play a lot of difficulty in expressing his feelings. I mean, it was very difficult for him to be able to.
Yes, he did. He did have a lot of difficulty expressing his feelings. I wouldn't say myself he had a lot of intimate friends. I don't believe he did. What he had was a very large number of old acquaintances who held him in the most utmost respect. And you could. It's been my fortune to know intimately three really major intellects in the mathematical field. And once you've met somebody like this, there's no mistaking it. And I'm a mathematician, but I mean, you talk to these chaps and you know they're 20 classes out of your league. And this is how Alan struck one. And so everybody had the most immense respect for him. I mean, one has to say that his sexual difficulties created this terrible tragedy. That wouldn't happen these days, because, I mean, he was pursued by the police for some, I don't know, approach he made to something. That's unthinkable now. No, there'd be absolutely no feeling of any
Yeah. I forget when he actually died.
It must be sometime in the early 50s, I think.
Right.
Well, now, he went off to the National Physical Laboratory to do work involved with computer and that kind of thing. And he had a massive interest, anything to which he could apply mathematics, he would pursue as a kind of sideline.
Did he die as he were in the height of his powers? Or did
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Loss?
Oh, it was an immense loss, yes. It's quite true that everybody says mathematicians do their best work when they're 25, and it's probably true. But, I mean, people of that calibre, like Einstein. And Einstein did his best work when he was 25, but he went on producing mathematics, which wasn't nearly so successful or radical, because you know, he tried to get a universal theory of all the forces in the universe, and he failed on that. But nevertheless, and even after publishing his two really important papers, Einstein went on producing very interesting ideas all his life. And this is true of lots of mathematicians. So I'm quite sure Turing had a lot more to come.
Again, on a personal side, who were Turing's other close friends? And the other point was, I wonder whether you knew his relations at all.
No, I didn't. He had a mother. He had a brother whom I never met his mother or his brother. You have to realise that my connection with Turing was limited to wartime, and mothers and brothers didn't get around much.
Right.
He was, of course, engaged for a short time to a girl called Joan Murray, who is here today.
Right.
She was Joan Clark.
Right.
She's actually Mrs. Murray.
Right.
She's here today.
Right.
I hesitate to ask her much about that, but you could well ask for her reminiscences on Alan. Bear in mind, they were engaged, but they didn't get married. I can imagine why not.
Yes.
Now, the people who are particularly close to him, Hugh Alexander, the British chess champion who's here, he was very close. A chap called Jack Good went off to America, became a professor. Sean Wiley, professor at Cambridge. These were the kind of people he went around with. He tended, I think, naturally enough to gravitate to the people who were mathematically minded and also connected with him loosely with the work.
Have you made many close friends or friendships at Bletchley which have remained or kept in contact with since?
I've made a number of people whom I know well enough that I can sometimes bring up after a gap of 30 years and you know, pick it up where you left it off.
Yes.
But of course I met my wife.
Yes. Yes, you mentioned a clarinet.
Yeah, well, we play a lot of music together. Of course, we had marvellous music here in the war because we had a large population. People rather from universities were rather inclined to be interested in music. We had a conductor, James Robertson, who was a professional conductor. We sported an amateur orchestra, which was complete in everything. We had everything.
Right.
We played a lot of that. Yeah.
Well, I'm a bit lost. I need to get back to my entrance.
Right. It's this way.
Going back to Turing, what I personally regret most of all is that then I was a very young, inexperienced young man of 23, just down from university. And I hadn't got the gumption to understand the privilege I was having getting to know him. And I wish to God now I'd spent more time talking to him about other things than what we were doing day to day. I bitterly regret that.
The party took place. It was a roaring success. I got all the press and had all of them in here and interviewed them. Now, what really made me determine this park was going to be saved was one small incident. I was walking around the park with these two men I didn't know from Adam. One was Harry Hinsley, and the other one was a chap called Stuart Milner Barry, who was the head of Hut 6. So you had the Harry Hinsley, of course, the Hut 4 man, also this became number two here, and also wrote the great his magnum opus, British Intelligence in the Second World War. He, in fact, was talking with Stuart Milner Barry and also with Edward Thomas, and they were walking down the lake, and I was walking with them. And they got round to where the steps are, and Stuart Milner Barry said, "Do you remember, Harry, when you came in roaring drunk and drove your cycle into the lake?" Because Harry, of course, was very sort of a straight-laced bloke. Harry said, "Yes," he said. "And do you remember what you said?" Harry said, "No," he said. Stuart said, "Please don't tell Hillary, please don't tell Hillary." Because, you see, Hillary was his girlfriend. He married her afterwards. But she also was a very quiet lady. And the thought of this chap she was going to marry, sort of wobbling up to the lake and probably falling in with his bike. And I thought, yes. That's the sort of thing we need. Not just the straight-laced stuff of the code-breaking. These were normal, ordinary people doing an extraordinary job. That's the story I wanted to get. So that's what really kicked the whole thing going, made us determined, or me determined, this site really was going to be saved. So that's how the whole thing took off after the party.
Jill Medway used to work up here trying to figure out some of the messages that had gone wrong.
He's going to find his wife.
Say who you are so that I can record.
Yes, my name is Peter Twin. And we're in Hut 8, certainly. And I worked with Joan Murray. She was Joan Clark in those days. And we all worked with Turing, and we worked on the Naval Intelligence. I joined the organisation in London in February 1939 and worked there with Dilly Knox and Tony Kendrick. The three of us were the only three working on Enigma, though Alan Turing came to see us about once a month. And we worked in Caxton House in London, and then the whole lot of us came down here August 39.
I moved to Eastcote when they shut up Bletchley Park. And do you remember, Rolf, I told many people this, we used to share the times, and if we were travelling on the same train, we did one word of a crossword, passed it over to the
That's
other.
Right, indeed.
If we weren't, then whoever had the times that day mustn't write it down, had to hand over the crossword in a virgin state for the other to.
I hope you still do the times crossword.
I still do the times crossword.
Yes.
Maybe I was better then at it, I don't know.
Have you been over to the stables? The old stables are attached to the big house round the back. That's very interesting historically, because when Dilly Knox and Tony Kendrick and myself were working on the Enigma came down in August 39, we were put to work there. And after about a few weeks, Alan Turing came to join us. In those days, of course, it was before we had solved the Enigma. So a lot of the very preliminary thinking and work was done in the cottage, not in these.
That's not the plum house or whatever, where Mr. Turing used to work.
Where Mr. Turing used to sit on the plum racks.
I don't recognize.
You haven't heard.
But, I mean, he'd sit anywhere.
Yes. I think Hut 8 must have been very recently built at the time I joined.
Yes, it was. It was just because we'd got the production line running.
Well, because there was what was picked up from a packet boat in the Norway.
Alan Turing was totally oblivious to any form of comfort, wasn't he?
Yes.
I was asked by one of your colleagues my views, which I gave him in extenso. I won't give them to you again.
I just wondered what the title of the play was.
Breaking the Code. It was a marvellous play, a marvellous representation of Alan. I don't know what you thought, Joan. You even got
actually,
an idea.
I didn't go. I thought it might
bring
be
yourself
rather
to do it.
Painful.
Yes. I don't think you would have found it so. It was a very sympathetic recording of him.
I helped his biographer, of course, Andrew Hodges. But, of course, they showed it in the States, too, and I think in Canada. It was a very successful play.
Bletchley Station!
Official photography first. Yes. Stand by.
Okay, everyone. I think we're actually ready.
Yes.
Hurry up. All right. Okay. For everyone, look to me first, please. A nice big smile. Let me have a quick look. Oh, it's rather good. Hang on. I'll do one more. Very nice. And one more, please. Lovely.
Okay. Right. All done. Okay, folks. One more thing. Now we're going to do the friends and family photos, but before I do that, it is traditional that we acknowledge your arrival here today. So hip hip
hooray,
hip hip
hooray,
hip hip
hooray.
Friends and family, do your photos.
We used to meet in the 1990s. Lots of us would go in there, but mark you, it's partly age where they, you know, may have passed on. It was such a friendly thing. It was my university. So it was that sort of atmosphere.
Yes.
If you ever met them afterwards. I went to college after I came out of the forces, but the army training and being with the others, I considered more my university.
I quite agree with you, Mary. Mm. I've always considered this to be my university because I never aspired to anything more than that.
No, I didn't really aspire, but because of Bletchley Park, I got the chance. I would never have got the chance without I'd been here. That was my, not inspiration, but my chance.
Yes.
Because after the war, I had no difficulty at all in getting good jobs.
We've just been listening in on two lovely ladies who both served in the ATS. Now, could you both just introduce yourselves for me?
Yes, well, my name is Betty Webb, which was Betty Vine Stevens when I was actually employed at Bletchley. And I was in the ATS, but that didn't mean very much because once here, you were just assigned to a department, and the fact that you were in a service didn't really mean very much. We just jogged along with the rest of our colleagues, whether or not they'd been in the ATS or the RAF.
I'm Mary Watkins, and I was at Bletchley Park during the war, and I worked mainly with other civilians. I was in the ATS, but the people I worked with were called computers in those days, in the way that typists used to be called typewriters. Mm. And that's how they did it with the computers. And I worked with these civilians. And I worked with the same group more or less all the time I was here in London, Caxton Street, to start with. And bit by bit, the contingent was moved as a whole body, first to Leicestershire, an outpost there. What was it called?
Bow Manor.
Was that Bow Manor?
Bow Manor Park. And that was the loveliest part of my career because it was like having a good clerical job and being looked after by orderlies.
It's a holiday.
Now you can imagine what fun that was to go and be taken care of.
I mean, we find this with anyone who served in any branch, that they're very proud of their branch. But I think especially you ATS girls are very proud of being ATS ladies,
aren't
you? Oh,
absolutely, yes. Yes, because some of us still are. I'm still a member of the WRAC Association. Yes. And it's a wonderful thing to be connected with. It was a tremendous camaraderie.
I've always been a club person.
Yes.
So it was, to me, it was ideal to be with other people in the club. I was a guide when I was young, and it was a continuation of the guides to me.
Yes, I can understand that, yes.
I've heard you in the past talking about the uniforms. Now, how bad were they?
When we first had them, they hadn't even a belt round them. They were plain in 40, and then they improved them by giving a belt to it. But the bad thing was they had stockings the colour of mustard. The most comfortable stockings you've ever met. They were fashion, but the colour was terrible.
Colour was awful, wasn't it? And they were
terrible.
Very thick.
Very thick,
yes.
and awful. And the more you watch them, the more horrible the colour became.
Too right, yes. But I think the worst part of the uniform issue was the knickers.
Oh,
because
yes.
Because they were so long that you either
passion
had
crushes,
passion
they were
passion
called.
Crushes. But you see, that they were so big that you either had the top up around your armpits, or if you had round your waist, the rest of it was
ankles.
Down round your knees.
Is it nice that you can get together here and meet fellow members of the ATS?
Yes, absolutely wonderful. I mean, it's another life, really, that we had then. And it's another life which people, you understand, but an awful lot of younger people don't.
No.
They can't envisage it.
Younger people can't. The past is a foreign country, and we're the past.
Yes, that's right. Some of them want to know, but the young generally can't envisage how it was.
Well, I suppose it's so alien to them. We do get a lot more people now are fascinated with, you know, World War II in general. And
yes.
Especially the more that the story is told about Bletchley Park, more interest we get here and the more we can tell the real story, your stories.
Yes, that's right.
I think
right.
That's what's important.
My granddaughter is particularly interested. You never bore her with telling her about it.
No, I never get bored listening to you ladies at all.
No, you're marvellous the way you soak it up.
And you two hadn't met before today?
No, I don't think so. No. I hope we meet next year.
I hope we will, yes. That would be lovely, yes.
Ladies, thank you both for your service.
We'd do it again, wouldn't we?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Do you want to just stand there and sort of point to it?
Yeah, all right. Sort of yeah, so he's just taking a picture of me in my brick.
What, are you going to do an interview?
Do it in my awful Cockney accent.
Oh.
Worrying about a Cockney
accent. It comes over so Cockney on here, it does really.
That's why we love you so much, Joyce. So you're back here again, Joyce.
Yeah.
Looking younger than ever.
Oh, thank you.
Fitter than ever.
Oh, no, not the fitter bit. No,
well,
miss that bit.
I always remember you running rings around me when we took you around here a few years ago. Yeah. And it's always good to see you. But this year,
yeah,
you've got your brick.
That's right. My daughter put it there for me to remember me by. So that's rather nice to come when I come here and look at it. Because it also means that she put it there for me, and that means a lot to me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she's very proud of you. I mean, I've spoken to her. She's so proud of what you did.
I didn't do anything. We didn't realise we were doing anything.
No.
No.
But that's the thing. I remember when we interviewed you, it was probably 4 years ago
I first came,
I remember specifically you said to us, we didn't do anything to do with Enigma.
No.
With Ultra.
No, and we said, it was no, all
but
there
you did.
Already. Yeah,
but you did.
Yeah, yeah.
And you didn't really, it's putting that connection together, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you were so compartmentalised.
That's right.
You just had your little job to do.
That's
you didn't
right.
know what the bigger picture was.
It's amazing when I come here and I see all these other people from other walks and they were here and I had no idea. We just came, did our work, went back every evening to Leighton Buzzard and that was it, you know. But, I mean, it's lovely to be part of it. It really is. And you can't help being proud of even being a tiny cog in it, really. You know, it's
That's good. And if the listeners could see the smile on your face when you say that, you are proud of what you do.
Oh, yeah, we
you
are.
Should be.
Yeah, yeah. It's something to remember and sort of live up to, isn't it? Yeah,
and you'll be on that wall forever now.
Yes, yeah. Now, I'm now going off to see if I can find any of my former boyfriends that were here. Haven't found any yet, but you never know.
Well, I'm Stanley Clegg. I'm now 95 years of age, getting on a bit. I was a member of SLU8, one of the special liaison units. I'm rather sad to say that my parents, although they lived to a great age, never knew what I did in the war years. They thought I was just in the RAF on a bomber station.
Oh, so you never got the chance to tell them?
Never ever. I went down to Liverpool to join a ship called the Monica Bermuda. Five of us, and we were all what were called cipher sergeants. We knew that we were going out to Algiers, but no one else on board knew. And of course, because we'd signed the secrets out, we didn't tell them. So we went across the North Atlantic. I remember us looking for icebergs and we sailed down the American coast and then off toward the Azores. And then we got to the African coast and we turned left at the traffic light and came up to the Straits of Gibraltar. And about 3 days later, we arrived in Algiers. I was on February 1st, 1944, I flew across to Naples.
Oh, my.
And I was then seconded to the headquarters at Caserta, where we supplied ultra information to the two generals, General Mark Clark of the American Fifth Army, and General Alexander was in full control. Round about mid-May, we broke through. I went back then to Caserta. So I actually lived in a palace at that time, Caserta's palace. And one Wednesday, I remember, we were told we had to move. So I went from riches to rags. I lived in a tent after that.
It's a bit of a come down.
In the south of France. Little knowing that within a couple of 3 weeks' time, the 15th of August, I would be taking part in the landings in the south of France with the American 7th Army and the French 1st Army. So we landed at a place which is well known now as a holiday centre, Fréjus. We then moved up, following the German army in retreat, up to several towns I remember the names of. Avion, Lyon, Dijon, where they make the mustard. And then at that point, I was in the front vehicle. I was getting close to Vittel, and I thought, I'd better just ask where we are. And there was a man dressed in riding breeches coming towards me. He was only about 5 feet tall. And so I stuck my head out of the vehicle. And when he got close, in my best French, I said, "Bonjour, monsieur. Hotel L'Hermitage," he replied. And I was a bit surprised at the reply, which sounded like this. "I'll land straight under this air bridge and go up road about half a mile and turn left, and they'll see place they're looking for on the route." And so I looked down at this man and said, "Blimey, where do you come from?" To which he said, "Well, actually, by profession, I'm a jockey, and I was racing at Longchamp in Paris in 1940, and the German army broke through that quickly. I couldn't get back to England," he said, "and I've been ensconced here in Vittel with a pile of other people." Anyway, 2 days later, I met this jockey again. He said, "I'm going home today." "Cool, blind," I said, "you're lucky, because I'd been out a long time then from home." I said, "Where do you come from then?" He said, "Batley in Yorkshire," which was fairly close to where I come from. "I come from Oldham in Lancashire." He said, "Give me your address of your parents. I'll go and see them when I get home." About 6 months later, I was one of the first to come on leave from the continent. And I got home, and I'd been home about a week before going back to France. And my mother said, "Yeah, I forgot to tell you, a little chap from Batley came to see me and said he'd seen you in this place in Vittel. And, you know, it's always upset me. I never had his address to thank him."
Aww.
I was put on what they call SLU forward position, and I was sent to Reims, where the peace was signed. And whilst the peace was being signed, I was passing information back to London so that it could be ratified by people in London. And so I can really say I was part of the peace signing system.
Yeah.
From Reims, I went to Frankfurt. I think from there is rather a human story, or a humane story, whichever. The war had only been over about 3 days. And I looked round Frankfurt, and as far as I could see, it was all knocked down. And I was picked up, went to an ex-German barracks, which were much better than our barracks, and we were told not to go out. We did our three-shift system, and when we came back to our billets in the barracks, all we could do was lie on our beds. Till after about 2 or 3 weeks, one of my colleagues said, "I'm sick of this." He said, "I'm going to get a wagon and go somewhere." So about 6 of us piled into a wagon, and we went through the camp gates, and we went about 7 or 8 miles out of Frankfurt, and we came to a small hamlet. I think it was called Karlbach. And when we got there, being with the American army, we never got short of cigarettes, although I've never smoked, or chocolate, or toffees. And so we'd previously put some cigarettes and toffees in our pockets. And within 10 minutes of us coming to this little hamlet, we were surrounded by children. So we emptied our pockets of toffees, and then the wife started coming out. And then about 5 or 6 men came out, and we handed them cigarette and tobacco, which in those days in Germany was used as currency. There was just one bar, and it was open, and it only sold cider, or as the Germans call it, Apfelwein. And so the following Saturday night, we decided we'd break camp again, which we did, and we went back to this village. And I remember us sitting in this single bar with the men and the women, and 2 or 3 weeks before we'd been killing them. And we were all holding hands and singing songs and having a good time on the Athol van. And I've often thought, when we start talking about wars, why the hell don't we all sit down together and have a glass of cider? From there, I went to Ghent in Belgium because Bletchley Park had packed up now.
Wow.
So there you go.
Oh, what a story. I think they should be calling you Phileas Fogg, not Stanley Clegg. You've been everywhere. What a fascinating life.
So people tell me. I didn't have a bed for 3 years.
No. But you did have a palace for a little while. That's brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Eric mentioned to me one of the things that failed on the bomb in the war was the same part, the pulse.
Don't ask me to repair it because I wouldn't know how to do that.
But I just think it's lovely that, you know,
a part that's failed,
something goes wrong and you're here. Yeah, that happened when I was doing it.
Yeah.
We've had another gentleman in, Paddy.
Paddy, yes, I spoke to him.
And he mentioned it to me as well.
Oh, did he?
He said, yes, the pools did fail.
Yes.
So it's something we've not
heard
of.
Of course they do. I mean, nothing is infallible. All things fail occasionally, don't they?
Did you and Paddy serve together?
No, I didn't really actually know him. I knew a Paddy, but I don't think that was the one. But then it's very difficult, isn't it? I mean, these years hence, they're going to look different. Same with that, I'm looking different, you know.
Oh, I imagine you look as
young
handsome as you did when you were married 6 years
ago.
Look,
I'm not saying I don't look handsome, I'm just saying I'm not as young.
You celebrated your 90th birthday recently.
I did indeed.
And your 60th wedding anniversary.
I did indeed. And how do you remember all that?
Because you told me so.
Oh, did I? And you remembered it?
Yes.
Good for
congratulations
you.
On
and
both.
And you've got a good memory, I haven't.
Well, I think you've got a fantastic memory, Eric.
No.
If you can walk in there and go, yep, that's the bit that used to go wrong. And it's stories like that that keeps the history alive, as far as I'm concerned.
Good.
So thank you very much. I hope you've had a good day.
Thank you very much. Yes, we have indeed. Yes, thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So you two chaps know each other?
Yes.
And did you work together during the war?
Yes.
What did you do?
We were
intercepted.
We were what were called telegraphist special operators, doing interception and reading enemy Morse.
Whereabouts?
Middle Hill, Y Station, top of the Rock of Gibraltar.
How long were you stationed there?
I was there for exactly a year, and Jeff joined about 3 to 4 weeks before I left.
So that was a brief spell that you spent together then?
Well, he remembers me, because I got involved in a few things, and the main thing that we've been talking about, the man in charge was a bit of a character called Chief Petty Officer Spooner, wasn't it?
That's right.
I think I've heard of him.
He had a black Dalmatian dog and he used to drink a lot and sleep a lot. And he was a real pain, wasn't he?
And I must admit, I didn't recognise, I didn't know Jeff. And I said to him, do you remember Spooner? And he said, yes. I said, did he sing for you? Because he used to have a few beers. And start singing. I said, did he sing, If I Catch Alfonso Spagoni?
That's right.
And he said, yes, he remembered.
With one mighty sweep, I will dislocate his Spanish jaw.
The Spanish
So you've just bumped into each other today then? You haven't been in touch all this?
Well, this
is what's happened. I thought it might happen to me. Because I put my name on the wall.
Ah, yes.
I thought somebody who's come here might see my name and contact me.
Not to put too fine a point on it, there aren't all that many chaps left.
No.
There's mostly women now.
Well, I'll be 95 in a few days' time, and he's 93.
What a chance to bump into each other then.
Well, lovely, because I remember that name so well.
Somebody told you that I was in Gibraltar, didn't they? And then you came over.
It's a short period of your life to remember so vividly all that time ago.
Well, we had such fun.
75 years ago, isn't it?
Yeah. But you remember quite a lot of detail by the sounds of it.
Yes, well, you see, on the BBC the other day, they did a play in Gibraltar, which took place there, at the Rock Hotel, which he knows and I know.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been back to Gibraltar?
Yes, I went back in 82.
And was it much different?
Oh, I could see the change was enormous.
What was it like there during the war?
All the women and children were evacuated and it became a garrison town. And I was told that there were 30-odd thousand troops there, mainly...
How difficult was it for you after the war when you couldn't tell people what you'd been doing? Because that was currency, wasn't it? What did you do in the war? That was
I think what you have to do is think, what happened when we all got home? There were hundreds of thousands of us came home. And people were not really interested in what you did. They were glad that you'd come home. And in our village, personal friends of mine, eight of them didn't come home. So it was forget it and get on with our jobs now.
I joined the war while I was in the Royal Navy. Used to go to all the art classes I could in Brighton and Gibraltar included. And just before I got involved, I was in Hong Kong. And I got involved in the black market. I made a lot of money because I wanted to just pay for my fees because I didn't know about grants. So when I got back, I looked at a thing called floodlights. At the top was Chelsea School of Art. So I went for an interview there, and to my surprise, this marvellous man, Harold Williamson, accepted me. So I was there for 5 years. I went down to Swansea for a year and came back again and got married to the most beautiful girl in the world, who unfortunately passed away. So, you know, I started my big, big, long career off. But the beginning was being in the Navy. It was a great adventure.
How does it feel to find each other today?
Oh, beyond belief. I couldn't believe my eyes.
Well, we're always playing down the chances of bumping into anybody you knew at these do's because there are, you know, at least 10,000 people here, never mind out in the field like you were, and even overseas. So the chances of bumping into each other, I think, are pretty slim. So that's lovely. It's been a pleasure to meet you both. Thank you. Enjoy your day.
I'll tell you this, the most fearsome, frightening message that used to come from the submarines was the convoy sighting report.
That's right.
WW.
That was a weather report. Di-da-da.
That's it.
And they were reporting. The submarine one was B-bar. Da di 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 da.
See, don't forget the Norse when you run it. That noise we heard of, the hair back of your neck, you stick out. Because you knew it was vital to get it. Because they'd sighted a convoy and there was lives to be lost. So it was vital that we get this message, pick it up and send it back here.
And have I remembered the correct frequency? I'm not sure which way around it was. I think the Atlantic, we shouted out all the fours.
Oh, yeah.
And so that the civilian in charge could get the HFDF chap to take a bearing.
Yeah.
And then the other one was 5025.
Mm.
And we used to shout it out, didn't we?
Yeah. And flirt with the wrens on watch.
I'm sat here with Audrey Hodges, and Audrey was a member of the Foreign Office staff who worked at Bletchley Park during the war. And I see, Audrey, that your original name was Cato. Now, does that mean you've got Roman heritage in you?
I think it must be, because I've got a Roman nose.
Now, what did you do at Bletchley Park during the war?
What did I do? I did typing, codings on the typewriter. You had to be very quick and fast.
Mm.
I didn't know where it went or anything like that because you never told anything.
No.
So, you know, it was just a job that I was doing for my country, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you join up?
No. I'll tell you what happened. I came out of college because I'm a very fast typist, but getting a job was difficult, but I got one. In a furniture shop for a little while. And then the furniture shop closed down. But then they put me in a factory where they made tops and dyes. was you had to put your hands in all the... I was no good at it, but I used to break the concrete.
And was this during the war?
This was during the war, and it was a small company, and the lady in the office took ill, and they called me and said, would I take over? So I took over. When she came back, I thought, I'm not going back in the factory again. Because you were put there, you see, whether you liked it or not. So then I went to the labour exchange, and I thought, right, I'm not going back. What are you going to do about it? And they said, would you go down to London? So I said, yeah, I'd have a go. Would you go to the Foreign Office? So I said, yeah. So I came down, had the interview.
So where did you come from originally?
I come from Newcastle-on-Tyne.
So when they said Foreign Office to you,
yeah,
did you think they want me to be a spy?
No, I didn't. I just accepted it.
And what happened when you got to London?
So when I got to London, they said, oh, have you got any bag of clothes or anything? So I said, no, but I said, she said, oh, you'll have to go back and get them. So we got a bag, and they didn't tell me where I was going or anything like that. And all of a sudden, they put me in this van with soldiers and took me here.
Really?
Yeah.
So had they told you what...
They didn't tell me a thing.
So when you got here, I guess you went through the usual process of our veterans. And did you sign the Official Secrets Act the first
day?
Was that when you realised this is a bit different to just a normal office job?
I suppose it was, yeah. I just thought to myself, well, I'm doing the same as my family are doing. One of them's in the army, and I'm, you know, protecting my own country, really.
A lot of the veterans I speak to, especially the ladies, they'll all speak about either their father being in the First War, or their brothers, or their fiancés being in the Second World War. And you did feel like you were doing your bit.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, because our two sisters were in the Land Army, and, you know, and the whole family was doing something, really. I just sort of accepted it. And then they put me in this digs.
Do you remember where they were?
Somewhere near Bedford.
That far away?
Yeah.
So did you have to get a bus every day?
No, the army used to come and collect me and bring me,
You got special treatment. So did you have to share a truck with soldiers every day then?
Yeah. Yeah, there and back. Used to come and collect me, and of course, you were on shift sometimes, and I was afraid of the dark. We had to go along this alleyway, and I used to see the soldier, take me along there, will you, to the house.
The actual work itself?
Yeah.
Did it give you any idea that you were doing something with code breaking?
I didn't realise what I was doing because nobody told anything. All I was told was to type these letters, you know, it came through on the machine. That was all I knew. Didn't know anything else.
So when you were demob,
and
then you spent 30 years not talking about it, do you remember in the 70s when the story first started coming out?
I don't.
No?
No.
When did you start talking about it to your family?
I can't remember, but I know as soon as it came out on news, on the television.
Probably was in the 70s.
It must have been in the 70s, yeah.
Now, today, you're not here on your own, are you?
No.
Who have you got with you?
I've got my two grandchildren and my daughter's partner and grandchild's boyfriend.
What's your name?
Nicole.
I've cheated and asked this question already before we started recording. How proud are you of your granny?
Extremely, very proud.
Have you always known this secret?
No. And only...
No.
When she started coming here, I don't think I really...
No, you didn't. No.
No. Only a few years ago.
So do you tell all your friends your granny was a spy?
Yeah.
Has it made you want to know more about what they did?
And... Yeah, like, do you really know what kind of went on here? So it's quite cool to have someone close to you that you can come here with, and you can say, oh, well, my nan worked here. And they're like, whoa.
And she did her bit to help the country when it was in its darkest hour.
That's right.
And all of you, from the most genius codebreaker down to the humble tea girl, you know, every single person who worked here had their part to play.
Yeah.
And do you look back, are you proud what you did?
I am, really, yes. I suppose I am, yeah.
You should be.
Yeah.
Audrey, can I just say thank you very much?
You're welcome.
And can I say thank you for your service?
You're very welcome. Been a pleasure.
wanted to say what may be the last word from the veterans, today anyway. How blessed we were to be here. And I was last here with the Duchess of Cambridge, and she said, well, what was it like working here? And I was sitting in Hut 6, exactly where I did sit when I was 18, when I first came here. And I said, well, I think in retrospect, what we did here was probably the most important thing that any of us did in the whole of our lives. And we were lucky. We were in the right place at the right time. We were able to do it, and we did it. And we're all proud of it.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.